Welcome to this episode of the Blue Economy Podcast with myself, Catherine O'Fallon, the Executive Director for the Marine Research Hub. And I am here today with one of my favorite people and aquanaut conservationist, documentary filmmaker. You could probably add in all of these different things after your name, but Fabian Cousteau is the name to go by. Fabian. So welcome to our first episode of the Blue Economy Podcast. I'm really happy that you are my first guest today. And I just want to tell everyone what this podcast is all about. Our mission and goal of this podcast is to really elevate and connect all the stakeholders in building the blue economy. So elevating the research so that we can commercialize and market these solutions so that they can be deployed to create jobs, build business, but ultimately take care of our greatest asset, which is the marine and coastal environments. And so that is why I'm really so excited that you are my first guest on this podcast, because you've been involved in the marine space and conservation and education and the exploration since you were born, and probably even before you were born.
We were all born of water, right? We spent the first 9+ months going in and living in water. So we're all aquatic
people. I wanted to start off because of how we met. This is great just to be able to chat with you. I was just saying we haven't talked in so long, so I feel like we're going to have a second episode. But first of all, do you remember how we first met, Fabian?
Kat, first of all, thank you for experimenting with me on your first podcast. But it's an absolute honor and pleasure to kick off this series, and I wish you much success for many years to come. How did we first meet? We first met when I have kicked off a series of very interesting projects in the Florida area. And you, being an educator, were a natural attraction to me because you and your brethren have been instrumental in shepherding the next generations. So it was a pleasure to go and visit you with you and your colleagues. And of course, all the young people who are, I hate to say years later, not so young anymore. But no, it's being a storyteller, being just a curious person, and being someone that has had the unbelievable privilege and honor to meet people such as yourselves and garnering friendships with you over the years is just a richness of life. I'm really happy that we're now getting a chance to chat again.
I know. It's been about 10 years since I was at New River Middle School. And I'll tell you, the thing that I remember the most the first time we met was I was a little starstruck, I'll be honest, because Jacques Cousteau, your grandson of Jean-Michel, and I met your dad at an event one time and had the pleasure to just chat with him a little while. So I'm still like, oh my gosh, Fabian Cousteau is coming to New River Middle School. But what I think was the most heartwarming part of your visit was when you had to leave. I'll never forget when you had to leave, and you won't remember this because you go all over the place.
Glad to get rid of me?
No, you go all over the place. You talk to so many people, but you were leaving and you said, you're like, no, not yet. Really, you were literally like, I don't want to leave yet. I've had so much fun and I feel like I did not get enough time with the kids that I want to come back. And I remember Miss Raposa, who's one of my former teachers, retired now and enjoying her retirement. But we said, we will have you back anytime. And you did. You came back probably the next year after traveling all over and doing more projects and stuff. But that was the thing that stuck with me all these years later, is that you basically said, I want to come back. I didn't get enough time with them. And that was the moment where I was like, okay, he's not just the grandson of Jacques Cousteau and the son of Jean-Michel. He is like this really passionate person who loves kids, loves educating them about the marine environment, loves sharing his passion and stories of his research and experiences with the future generations to really hopefully spark that continued passion. So that was my first memory of really getting to spend some time with you. And I'm so glad that all these years later, we're still in touch. Thankfully, I've also spent more time with us at the Marine Research Hub, which is where I left education and stepped out into this role to have a greater impact in our community. And last year, or no, 2 years ago now, you were our judge for the Marine Innovation and Sustainability Award at the Fort Lauderdale International Boat Show. That was our first year, basically elevating solutions in the marine industry space and the yachting community and how they are taking steps to be more sustainable, more innovative, and really do their part to take care of the environment. Next year, we're going to talk about how you can come back again and visit and be a part of continuing to just spread the message of innovation and ecosystem building. And yeah, I'm just looking forward to having some more time to talk to you today. And I think for a lot of people, hearing the name Fabien Christou and is obviously connected to your grandfather quite a bit and to your father as well. But you've been doing since you were like, how old were you when you started scuba diving?
Jeez, I was 4 years old. It's actually on my fourth birthday when I did my first open water scuba experience. And it, as a very young person, first of all, to those who are listening, don't do that with your kids.
Don't do that.
With special circumstances, luckily, I had a few folks in my family who knew how to scuba dive and had done so for a few years. But, you know, it was a special experience in that it captured my attention. Imagine being a four-year-old. And this isn't a pool. This is my first open water dive was in Catalina Island off of California. And you're full of curiosity. You're full of lack of barriers without being able to find other words for that. And so your energy abounds, your want for knowledge abounds, and in a very young way. And so going into this foreign realm, with breaking the chains of gravity to be able to go in any direction you want with obviously expert guides, but more on the primary level, just your eyes are open to this. It happened to be a beautiful day, a beautiful sunny day, very calm, all that stuff. Clear water, which is not always the case in California, and at least in that part of California. And going down to about 30 or so feet and looking up, and you're in a kelp forest. So you have these ribbons of green that are just undulating. You've got all this color and movement from the different sea creatures to the Garibaldi, which have these bright orange pops of color in that green field, green and blue field. And then you have the shafts of light that, just like the backgrounds that we have here, just give you this sense of walking into this monumental cathedral of life. It's just so awe-inspiring, and you're immersed in it. So it's not just seeing it on a two-dimensional screen the way we do nowadays with social media, but really being immersed in a way that you feel the cold, the tingling a little bit, the stinging sensation of 54 degrees and that water rushing in, which kind of wakes you up, right? Makes you still for a second, which is good for 4 minutes. But then you're looking around, you're going, oh my God, this is amazing. And looking at the surface world, which is this shimmering plane above you, and looking at the bottom world, which is this movement of just amazing alien sea creatures, the creativity, the imagination, all of that just infuses you with an eternal curiosity of what's next, what's beyond that next coral reef, what's beyond, what is that sea creature doing? It's captured my imagination since then. And I've been on expeditions since I was 7. I've always looked forward to the next dive. A seemingly mundane dive can be extraordinarily interesting just in a square yard, if you will, of space for an hour, 60 feet, 60 minutes. Now it's even less than that. But even in a recreational diving setting, it's fascinating if you just look, if you just sit there and observe. And if you have the unbelievable privilege of diving with megafauna, sharks and whales and dolphins, and all those things that people usually focus on, obviously, it's awe-inspiring. But to me, that's what kicked off my curiosity. I had the luck of being surrounded with a family of that same curiosity who built their careers on exploration, underwater, undersea exploration. And at that point, and still to this day, a lot of the tools are missing. Now, granted, in co-inventing the Aqualung was a huge help, then followed by building the first underwater cameras for filming underwater events, to building some of the technologies like side scan sonars with other amazing people like Dr. Harold Edgerton from MIT. And the list goes on and on, have really been this continuous cycle of wanting to go longer, deeper, and further and understand our undersea world and how the underpinnings of what that is, the essence of why we are, who we are and where we're going.
And yeah, being able to go deeper, longer, spend more time and learn, because we know very little about the ocean compared to our other ecosystems. I used to tell my students when they started the class and we had the first page of their book, and I said, we know basically amount of one period on this whole page of words of the underwater world. So you're right. So before we move on, I have to ask you one question: is where is your favorite? You've been diving all over the world. All over. Where would you say was your favorite place to dive?
The next place.
The next. There you go.
It's really difficult because so many dives have shaped my life, my thought process, the way I experience things on land. It's amazing that I could even. So my team has calculated the number of hours, and I don't know this to be fact, but supposedly they arrived to around 25,000 hours of
underwater time.
So I'm permanently narked, basically. All this to say that every dive has a really interesting thing to learn and experience, mm-hmm. if it's a seemingly mundane dive. Sometimes it's about yourself. Sometimes it's about your equipment. And most often it's about the environment that you've decided to go and explore. And even if it's something like a mantis shrimp or an octopus, by the way, being my favorite invertebrate, but it's always
there.
Oh, I love octopus. I love cephalopods in general, but octopus have been fascinating to me since I was young.
That's awesome.
Many reasons.
Yeah. I think so many, like you said, everyone loves the megafauna a lot when they feel like they want to dive, but I always love the smaller stuff as well.
Yeah.
When I saw my first nudibranch in the South Pacific, and I was just like, the colors are just like amazing, and they're so different and so similar to each other. But yeah, like the little things sometimes are the most fascinating to learn from.
You're being based in Florida, you must see a lot of amazing nudies all around the place. It's one of my favorite smaller creatures as well, is just the variety and the shapes and the way they act can be very different depending the whole predator prey thing. Everything is just amazing about them. And to your point, it's not always about the big stuff.
Yeah.
We know so little about our ocean world. We've explored maybe 5%, 7% to any extent. And that's a generalization. If you take a scuba diving range, including advanced scuba diving, recreational mm-hmm. scuba diving, let's say we take the first 300-foot layer of our ocean, that's 5% of our ocean world. The average depths, the deepest parts of the ocean, the mountains that are three times as tall as the land-based mountains, so on and so forth. We have so much left
to learn.
And then the dynamics, right? The interaction between species and how we interact with the ocean, how we affect the ocean and the ecosystems, including, of course, the flora and fauna that lives in that space, and how that in turn affects us. And that could be on a nuts and bolts aspect of how that affects the economy of Florida, for example,
mm-hmm.
or how we affect the migratory patterns of animals, the breeding cycles, depending on what we input and output from the ocean world. So we can talk about more of that kind of level of interaction and cause and effect. But on a primordial level, just the feeling that ocean gives to us, tangibles and the intangibles. How does it make you feel to walk on the ocean front on a beautiful beach on a summer eve during a sunset? What's the value of that? How does it make you feel when you walk onto a beach on a vacation and you see a pile of garbage? So that's a negative effect.
Yeah.
How do you feel when you are going down for your very first open water scuba dive? Once you get past the testing and everything else and you're free to do what you want.
Yeah.
How does it make you feel? How do you feel? Yeah. You bump into your first large fish, a permit or a tarpon or even something bigger like a shark, whatever.
Yeah.
How do you feel? These things are very little quantified.
Yeah.
But some of the richest experiences that make you fall in love with why ocean is so important.
Yeah, and those are the feelings that make you want to be more involved in preserving and protecting the ocean. It's if you feel connected to it, if you feel it's an important part of who you are and important for your family, your lifestyle, you know, what you enjoy, then you're going to become probably more, obviously more involved in it on different levels. Some people are like, I've always wanted to be a marine biologist, but they also are starting, we're starting to realize you can still love and take care of the marine environment and be involved and support taking care of it and building this ecosystem and not be just in that little box of doing one thing. You can bring your talents and passions. And yeah, it's the reason why we do things is those feelings that you're talking about.
I would even go a little, push the line even further in saying that not only finding the passion to relate to the ocean and doing something about it and all that, but I would push it even further in the sense that I'm looking at our backgrounds, right? So there are a lot of bubbles. Even on the most basic levels, we should be looking at the ocean as if we depend on it, because we do. Mm-hmm. And reference to the bubbles is a simple one, but one that most people, the 8.7 billion and growing, don't necessarily connect with. But about 60% of our oxygen that we breathe is generated by the ocean world, right? Mm-hmm. The only reason we exist, as a general statement, is because we are a little oasis in space, right? Mm-hmm. The ocean is what gifts us life. And so we need to understand that in order to have a healthy existence and a healthy future, we need to protect our oceans as if our lives depended on it, for all sorts of reasons, not just the basic life support reasons, which of course are paramount, but also for a health of an economy. We need to look at it as a natural resource bank account and manage it as such and live off the interest that it bears rather than eating away the capital. We also need to look at it as a teaching tool. How do we, as a species interdependent on the web of life, move forward in a way that is beneficial not only to us, but also to our life support system? And that means making decisions that are informed decisions, so that we can do that in a way that's respectful to the sentient beings that we share this space with, but also to our future generations. And that requires an investment in the understanding of the dynamics of our relationship with our oasis in space, our little ocean world. And I can't overstate that, because we spend 1,000 times more, and even more so these days, in space exploration than we do ocean exploration, right? Okay. And so if we look at that lesson, in the hundreds of billions that have been spent in the last decade in space exploration, it spawned off over 1,700 new businesses just in that little private space industry alone. And if we look at that and we look at the possibilities for ocean, we're missing the best investment we can have. And so I urge people, let's also look at the reality that you and I are scuba divers, right?
Yeah.
But there are only about 3 million active scuba divers in the world. So we're a very elite crew. And those are recreational scuba divers. If you look at professional scuba divers, that demographic shrinks drastically. Scientific and professional scuba divers, technical divers, et cetera, et cetera. There are only about 12,000 new technical divers trained every year worldwide. So this is a very small demographic. And so it's incumbent upon those who have the privilege of being able to go scuba diving to bring back those messages, bring back that information that can benefit the greater public, whether it's in public or private industry, or just for education purposes, which of course is the baseline.
Yeah. And when you talk about space, the ocean is, the deep ocean is also space exploration. And there is a huge, a really good tie to it. All the people who are astronauts who go into space. You're an aquanaut, you go below. But most
very little known term, by the way. People don't understand the term. It's basically an astronaut underwater. Yeah. There are very specific parameters to qualify as an aquanaut. And that means that you have to essentially living and working out of in saturation. That's important. In saturation, that requires special training for over 24 hours. and living and working, not just surviving. So it's not just a shelter, which is an underwater structure that can preserve life, but one that functions as an underwater marine laboratory, as one that you can sleep and eat and have normal daily functions, as well as being able to have excursions. And the saturation part is extremely important within that definition, because your body is a fantastic, malleable thing. And for those who don't scuba dive or who may not go beyond the recreational scuba diving, essentially saturation diving in many ways is flipping the recreational scuba diving rules on its head, right? Instead of avoiding decompression obligations, you maximize your decompression obligation, which does two things. It gives you a tool that no other tool in the toolbox of ocean exploration does, which is it gives you unprecedented access to the ocean world. All of a sudden, you're breaking the bonds of time, which is my biggest frustration as a scuba diver, right? The limits of time. As soon as things start getting interesting, you have to go to the surface.
Go up.
So here, you're doing the exact opposite, right? So now, all of a sudden, you have the ability to access that underwater world from an undersea marine laboratory or habitat structure. It's based underwater for hours and hours and per day until you get tired or you're hungry or need to sleep or some such. And the negative aspect, which is why not that many people do it, is that you can't go to the surface. Whether it's an emergency or routine, you have to do your deco underwater or in an environment, a staged environment, dry or wet, so that you can safely regain access to the topside world, the unsaturated world. But that's worth the payoff, or that's worth the risk and payoff, because in the case of Mission 31, as you mentioned in the intro, we were able in those 31 days to do the equivalent of 3 years worth of scientific research. So incredible. That took the of time and access to the bottom world is extraordinarily precious and valuable. And it's not, this approach does not preclude or supersede any other approach, right? Diving from the surface is still valuable. Boats are extraordinarily valuable. AUVs are valuable, sensors and so on. All those things are valuable, satellites, et cetera, but we're missing that valuable tool, that saw or that hammer that was pioneered back in the early 1960s.
Yeah, and Mission 31, we'll talk just to touch on that for a little bit more, because Mission 31 took place in Florida, down in the Florida Keys, at the aquarium.
I'm sensing a common theme here.
A common theme of Florida in here, but yeah, Mission 31 was down at the Aquarius, which is the marine laboratory aquabase down here in Key Largo. And yeah, tell us a little bit more about that. And how did it come about that you decided to do 31 days of living and working in Aquarius? And like you said, 3 years worth of data collection, which is just crazy to think about how much you're able to accomplish. And yeah, tell me just a little bit more about it, because I've seen stuff and heard it, but we really haven't talked about it very much personally.
So Aquarius has been this amazing undersea marine laboratory that's been around longer than I believe any other undersea marine habitat. And I use those words interchangeably, but essentially, I believe it was deployed in 1984.
And I think was it first in St. Thomas or someplace in the Virgin Islands before it moved to Key Largo, if I'm not mistaken?
Believe it or not, it was slated to be permanently based in the Channel Islands off of California. It was based on a rail system that could bring it up and down.
Oh, I did not know that.
Subsequently, it went to the Caribbean and then to Florida.
Okay.
So it went from a rail system idea to a barge deployment idea, bringing it up and down like an elevator when missions were over.
Mm-hmm.
And this is for many factors, including the idea that it would be easier to maintain, which is a huge problem in a saltwater environment.
Saltwater, right? People in Florida know that probably too, with a little corrosion and stuff we got going on. Yeah.
Anyone who's owned a boat will understand, or lives near the sea will understand what maintenance is all about with salt water. But eventually, what was decided is to have a semi-permanent cradle about 5.5 miles. So it's about 9.5 miles, 9 miles sailing to get to it because of the peninsula. But essentially they found a semi-permanent location to base Aquarius for the last almost 30 years now.
So with Mission 31, like what sparked you to do that? What was the conversations and discussions leading up to that? Because I people talk about you being underwater for 31 days, but it's like, how did you guys decide that was what you were going to do?
Who had that crazy idea? It stems from, I guess, the more I think about it, the more I visit it psychologically, maybe it's a frustration that I had from all the stories that I heard growing up. My grandfather built some of the first underwater habitats, Conch Shelf One, which was the first underwater habitat in history. And in parallel to that, the Men in the Sea experiments had deployed an underwater shelter where that also was kicked off for the United States. They were a week apart, I think. And Conch Shelf Two, after Conch Shelf One's successful week-long experiment happened in the Mediterranean, Conch Shelf Two was built and deployed in the Red Sea. And it was the subject of an Oscar award-winning film from my grandfather called The World Without Sun, which had followed his success with The Silent World, which kicked off his career, his filmmaking and exploration career. And so that highlighted a whole underwater village ecosystem where they stayed for 30 days. And I found that amazingly fascinating. And not to shun Conch Shelf 3, which is a deep water experiment down to close to 100 meters for, I believe it was 3 weeks. And so all of this culminated in my frustration of having been born too late in history.
You missed all the fun there.
This completely missed the fun, at least for those. There have been, if you look at and count the underwater structures that have been pioneered all around the world for decades, there have been about 70 or so underwater structures like this, and by structures, shelters and habitats in all sorts of bodies of water. But they've been purpose-built. And the one of the exceptions in purpose-built short-term durations, a few months or a few years, and then they were pulled out of the water. And one of the exceptions, of course, is Aquarius that's been continuously running, I believe, the longest time in history. And so having had the opportunity to go and visit a close family friend of ours, Dr. Sylvia Earle, and her team, who were trying to save Aquarius, I believe, in 2012, I had, for the first time in my life, been able to experience for 47 minutes, because we were in a line to stay longer than that, Aquarius during their mission. And of course, I gave Sylvia a hug and met some of their team members, including Dr. Mark Patterson from Northeastern University, who's now part of our team, who really opened my eyes to what it was like. And then that shepherded the whole, like, we need to save this habitat. We need to be able to do something unprecedented or unusual based out of the last remaining undersea marine laboratory. And as Conch Shelf 2 reminded me that it was 30 days in the Red Sea, I felt like symbolically we should do one day longer. And there was some resistance to that. It's not easy. And Aquarius already having been fairly antiquated at the time and having and being in the hurricane belt and everything else is a big risk.
Yeah.
Because once you're saturated, like I said, you can't just go straight to the surface. You have extensive deep compression obligations, about 19.
Yeah. How much time? 19 and a half hours or so? Okay.
Yeah. If you're saturated three atmospheres, which is where the wider interface for Aquarius is, it's 19 and a half hours.
So not if there's a storm or something going on up on the surface that could be impacting you. It's not like they can just pull you up and take you out.
This is a 200 ton object. You don't just pull it right up. And there are protocols for this, obviously.
Yeah,
I'm dramatizing everything. But you know,
there's a lot of team experts and everyone who dealt with all this. But like you said, it's something that had to really be considered very seriously. It's just going one extra day versus what had already been done before.
Yep. Well, that said, despite the naysayers who were saying, oh, it's impossible, NASA did 17 days and that was difficult and everything else, I said, it is possible. It's just a matter of figuring it out. And this, I think this is a commonality of our trepidatious nature of pushing the boundaries and going beyond the known. And having seen all the evidence in the past and knowing that there are capabilities of pushing these boundaries within relative safe margins if you plan for it, plan A, B, C, D, et cetera. I knew it was possible. And I felt like there were two experiments that needed to happen during those 31 days. One, is this a conducive platform to doing advanced research? And for what reasons? And what is it that we can get out of this platform that's unique that other approaches can't do? And two, does the public care? Mm-hmm. Can we reach the public in a storytelling fashion that can ignite their curiosity of the ocean world in a public forum that's valuable, that can highlight the importance of ocean to us, right? Mm-hmm. To give ocean a voice. And so I'm happy to say that despite the challenges of getting to that point and getting through the 31 days, it was successful on both ends. As we mentioned before, 3 years worth of scientific data because of many factors. Maybe I pushed my team a little hard, but this may have been at that perspective in 2014, which is over a decade ago. And we weren't sure we were ever going to be able to do this again. They were going to pull Aquarius out. This is the last habitat, so on and so forth. So let's see what we can do in the time we have. And bringing down young aquanaut candidates, and really, aside from the expert engineers who were with us, and obviously the amazing crew over at ARB, Aquarius Reef Base on land, and the surface support that we got from the U.S. Navy, the universities that participated, and so on and so forth.
It's a big team of people working on all this. There's a lot of, we could spend a whole time talking about the careers that are connected to just taking care of this. And I think that might be for another conversation, but it did take a massive amount of people to make this all work because 24 hours a day for 31 days. Yeah.
Space, right? Think about the missions that go to the space station. You've got mission control with hundreds of people. You've got obviously a few astronauts in space, but you've got an enormous support structure and team that makes that possible. And it's the same underwater.
Yeah.
And look at the way a ship runs, right? A research ship of size, of note. A lot of times you'll have 30 some odd people to send off one AUV.
Yeah. You know, it's a lot happening, and there's so many different skill sets that are needed to be in this space for sure. And I think that's an important.
They're not all scuba divers.
they can't be. Like, you can't have everyone doing the same thing. It's not gonna get anything done if you have everybody who is with the same skill set and background and knowledge as well. And mission 31
experts. You've got engineers. You've got programmers. You've got captains. You've got deck crew. You've got submarine pilots. You've got boat captains. You've got obviously scuba divers and scientists of all ilk. The list goes on and on of the breadth of expertise that one needs and the breadth of information and data and experiments that benefit all those different verticals of careers.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you also were able to film to do live broadcasts while you were underwater. I think we did one with New River Middle School at the time, or multiple maybe even, but you did live broadcast. And that goes back to what you were talking about, is telling that story and really using the platform that you had to not only for the research and the science and the innovation and technology data, but also to inspire the next generation of potential aquanauts was really powerful. I think it was definitely an opportunity that I thought was just amazing. I wanted to be down there too. And the kids I know felt the same way. So I think that's new technology as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We had to upgrade all the systems on Aquarius, especially for the live casts. And I had better Wi-Fi at the bottom of the sea than I did in my apartment in New York City at the time. That's pretty amazing.
And
having live streams and being able to communicate with you and the kids, doing a weather channel projection of weather patterns on live TV, doing interviews with CNN, all those things were amazing. And we did they were Skype in the classroom sessions back then because Skype was.
Yeah, that's when we used Skype.
But
yeah.
Not Zoom. So we do Zooms, but different platforms, a similar way to reach out and now even more interactive. But the point is that when people think ocean, it's not always just about conservation. It's not always just about marine biology. And to be able to get people excited, no matter what their career path is, we had accountants, obviously, because we had to make sure that our budgets were. So it really does affect a whole wide breadth of career paths. And I think that's where the message gets lost when we talk about ocean and ocean conservation.
Yeah.
Those things are, of course, paramount of importance, but let's not forget that it can be beneficial to a whole variety of different career paths, from the park rangers to the recreational scuba diving industry to the fishing industry and so on. And of course, engineers and so on.
Yeah.
You know, build the next AUV, putting it in an extreme environment and testing it is extremely important before, for example, you send a $1 billion piece of equipment into space and see that it doesn't work.
You know,
the list goes on and on. I can go and have a diatribe. But this is what we learned.
This is what we learned from all this. And I think I'm jumping to what you're working on now. I think it segues really perfect because Proteus obviously is like the next generation of Aquarius and what you're working on with Proteus. So I'd love to spend some time talking about what you are currently right in the middle of, because I've gotten to see some renderings of Proteus, but it's been a little while since I've heard what's happening. So yeah, tell us, mission 31 have an impact on the idea of Proteus and what you're doing with that? And probably even back to the conch and all the different underwater habitats that used to be around that no longer are around. So yeah, tell me what's going on with Proteus, and obviously to our listening audience, about what is Proteus?
Yes, Proteus in Greek mythology is the eldest son of Poseidon. He was the shepherd of the sea and keeper of knowledge. So I figured that was a pretty good mythical god to have as messaging. And really, it's the experience at Aquarius that was the aha moment of society, globally speaking, is in a moment in history, a crucial moment in history, and we can't let our opportunity slip by us before it's too late. And Aquarius was the highlight of, wow, we have to build a state-of-the-art facility. And we're humbled by the pioneers of the past. We've learned so much from the experiences of the folks at C-Lab, Hydrolab, obviously Conshelf, Helgoland, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And to try and address, to stand on the shoulders of past giants, of their experiences, their successes, and to try and address some of the frustrations that have happened in the past, to build a underwater facility that is large enough to cater to bringing as much of the equipment and facilities possible to be as detached from the surface as possible for extended periods of time, only leverages the unique assets that an underwater habitat has. And to be able to incorporate modern approaches, including modularity and upgradability, so that we can keep up with the demands in a decade or even two, if we're lucky enough to stay that long, or maybe even longer. And to have a way to address today's needs as our resources fall short, as our needs of counterbalancing our impact, which breeds opportunities. It breeds a new technology opportunities. How do you deal with waste management? Not only does that pertain to space colonization, but it also pertains to underwater applications, and even more specifically than any of that, to land-based applications for communities at large, so that we can live in a more fair balance with our resources and our life support system, the ocean, our ocean planet. And between that and food systems and power systems, how do we incorporate as many new approaches, whether it's saltwater batteries or OTEC or land or solar and wind or wave action, or maybe it's a hybridized system that allows us to power a facility indefinitely. Obviously, we're talking about saltwater, but all these things are incorporated into the Proteus ecosystem and philosophy so that we can minimize our footprint and maximize our learning capabilities, which enhance the ability to benefit our partners, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of things of partners in different realms in industry. It benefits the community at large. So there's a public benefit to this. And of course, the whole marine biology and engineering aspects of the Proteus ecosystem benefit from this as well. You saw a rendering. Obviously, the renderings have evolved since then to architectural realities, which is amazing. So I can't wait to show you some of the newest evolution of Proteus 3.0. And we're at a point now where we're getting close to manufacturing and deploying. And that isn't just about building something, right? Mm-hmm. It's also about addressing what the needs of the inhabitants will be, as well as what the benefits to investors and to universities and nonprofits will be.
And so, where, and Yotza, I know where this is located, one of my favorite
places
in the entire world.
That part.
Glazed over where it's going to be. It's going to be based in Curaçao.
Yeah.
So why did you pick Curaçao?
It was difficult. I've got to say, there are a lot of amazing opportunities for locations around the world, and some that, of course, we haven't even discovered yet. We have to start somewhere.
Yep.
And I've got to say that during this journey, this multi-year journey, which started during COVID, by the way, which not the right time to start a new project. But despite that, the enthusiasm by the from the people we talked to, including school children all the way up to business executives, high net worth individuals, investors, and so on and so forth, has been unprecedented. So it's really fueled a reality, a realization that this is the new space race. And the opportunities are not just to build one habitat, but a series of different underwater habitats for different needs in the local environments. In Curaçao, we had so much enthusiasm since the beginning that it became a natural place for us to look at. And the cross sections of what will make this project a reality, which is, what is the topography underwater? What are the immediate opportunities strategically in an ecosystem such as this for marine biology, the baseline, right? So marine mm-hmm. biology research.
Yeah.
In the photic and mesophotic zone and maybe even beyond that. And what is the land infrastructure capabilities? Because we still have to be communicating to the surface, right?
For
what,
sure.
what our
yep.
needs are, what our discoveries are, and so on and so forth. So you still need to be able to have proximity. And what are the other aspects that give us maximum opportunity? So in the case of Curaçao, we're beneath the hurricane belt. So that means
yeah.
we can function even in tropical storms without the need to execute an exit strategy. And that, I'm sorry for the earthbound brethren, you may be brunting the majority of the storm. We can keep functioning underwater because we're essentially in Curaçao unscathed
yeah.
or unimpeded by that. And that gives us other opportunities. What kinds of research can we do during a tropical storm, right? How does that affect current? How does that affect
yeah.
the ecosystem and the beings? How do they react to a storm? If they react at all, what are the possibilities of creating new systems and new sensors for those ecosystems? How does an AUV react in open water, for example, during these storms? And how, and deployment and retrieval of that equipment as well, and so on and so forth. And of course, Aquanaut technologies as well evolve, the suits, the helmets, the communications, the tethering and the tethered and untethered features of this, the rebreather systems, and so on and so forth. And then the equipment we have in our hands. One of the things that I think is overlooked way too much is during Mission 31, and granted, again, decade-old technology now, but we were able, because of the human element, bring down technologies that were simply too fragile to deploy on their own, that were
yeah.
normally relegated to land-based laboratories that had pipettes that were so fragile and so costly, they're $10,000 a piece, but we were handling them underwater as human beings that robotics simply can't mimic. So that human technological interface that is offered by an underwater platform like Proteus will give us the ability to do these things that we often don't talk about, but these are the nuances that just add value, so much value, to an underwater platform that has all the equipment necessary on site.
And I think one of the unique things that also Proteus, you're talking about education and research, but that commercialization of the research-based solutions can also be validated with within the structure and the ability of what Proteus can do. And I think that's one of the things that we're trying, we, myself and others in this space are trying to promote, is that these research-based solutions are going to be the things that are going to help solve some of our greatest challenges. And we have to validate and prove them so that they can build those businesses, create those jobs, and solve, take care of our greatest asset, like I said at the beginning. And I think that's something that you're trying to build into the model of Proteus that maybe earlier we weren't as focused on, maybe. And it's just because things have been changing over time. And now we have the ability to focus more on how can we validate the research, the solutions, so that they can really solve those challenges. So can you just touch on that a little bit and how you 100%. Incorporated that into the model of Proteus?
One of the fundamentals of Proteus since its inception has been to give, to be a platform, a United Nations platform, so to speak. One of the most fundamental aspects of the nuts and bolts of Proteus is giving science a voice, right? Being able to reach out to the public the way NASA's been doing successfully for decades, and now the space industry in general. Being able to highlight, for example, the way Dr. Sylvia Earle did with her first all-women team back in the 1970s, which was met with a lot of resistance back in those days. To be able to highlight women empowerment and be able to look at a mixed demographic mission that highlights and leverages the assets that brings to the table, all the different knowledge bases and so on and so forth that you can bring together. Again, the way space has done for decades through government, now through private industry. It's very important to be able to tell the stories. And as much as the science is important, we need to be able to bring in the storytelling elements. And the live streams during Mission 31 were an aha moment for us, that it's an integral part of our ecosystem to be able to have infallible communications, whether it's, I'm always amazed that there's so many people out there that just love watching live streams, whether it's on TikTok or some other platform. And it's pretty, to me, I'm a Gen Xer. I like tactile stuff, but it's amazing to me that younger generations just can watch and binge watch this stuff, which I find mundane, but they obviously are very interested in. And, yep. and that's the important part, right? Is connecting yep. with generations in whatever way is necessary to be able to get them involved. And so if they like watching live streams, we needed to be able to provide that. And for the other, for other generations or anyone who enjoys series, sorry, we need to be able to produce yep. those things.
Yeah, meet everyone's needs and where they're at. I used to put on, there was an underwater
this is what
camera.
We're doing right now.
We're doing it now. But I used to put on the underwater camera view from, I think, in Fort Lauderdale, like just in the background while my students were working sometimes. And, oh, look, there's something went by. But yeah, we never thought we would be doing some of this before in different platforms of sharing information and passion and knowledge and really sparking the next generation, but also getting more people involved in the solutions that are out there. And if they don't, they don't know what they don't know. And so we have to find and use every method possible to make sure that we're engaging everybody in the ways that they want to be engaged. And I think that's to your point, is that however it works for one person, it may not work for the other, but giving them all those platforms and tools is going to propel us forward with solutions to take care of our environment and basically get that next person involved in this passion project that you started from your grandparents and your parents. And you had that great opportunity, like you said, from your family members, where others are going to get that great opportunity from you because they saw you on Mission 31 when they were a kid, or they saw you now with moving on to Proteus, and they want to be a part of that next generation of explorers, aquanauts, or engineers, or solving our water quality challenges. And they want to work for companies that are like that. And they may not be the person who wants to be underwater, but they may want to be the marketing person for that company. And
that's fine. I mean, not everyone can do these things. As a matter of fact, a lot of people probably wouldn't want to. They'd be interested in looking, but they wouldn't necessarily want to do what we do.
Then that's okay.
That's perfectly fine. But as long as they're engaged, and engage not only in the curiosity and the love for the ocean, but also in the solution building. That's all that's requested. And that's the goal, right? And look at the success of the JSON project, for example, that kicked off a long time ago. That was very successful in its day. And it still has a positive repercussions to this day, today. And of course, it's all Sylvia's work and many people, many unsung heroes
that
never get a chance or may not want to have a public voice, but should absolutely, their work should absolutely be highlighted. It's so important to connect with, I hate to say it in this way, but the average person who may not know the ocean in the way we do, but should at least be engaged in a way that they appreciate. That's my grandfather summarized it in a very simple way, which is he said, people protect what they love what they understand, what they're taught. And I'm saying this to you. I think I said it at New River Middle School when you were there. And I'm always ashamed to say this in this way. But my biggest heroes, of course, are educators, but I was a terrible student in school. I would never pay attention, and I apologize to those educators out there. I would always be staring out the window because that next adventure to me was coming up. And I had amazing in the field teachers, my grandfather, for who he was, my grandmother, the unsung hero of that generation, who was the first female scuba diver, the first female aquanaut in history. And was really the true captain of Calypso, by the way. And you had to be. She was the granddaughter of an admiral, the daughter of an admiral. And she, in those days, that wasn't allowed in the French Navy, but she would have loved to have been a sailor. And so her revenge, so to speak, was she was on Calypso more than my grandfather, my father, and my uncle combined. So she was the unsung hero. And then my mother, who was an expedition photographer, and my father, who was an expedition leader, all those people and all the amazing crew that tolerated me, this little bratty kid who was always asking what they were doing and wanting to get involved, those were my teachers. And I had the unbelievable luck to be able to be taught in the field by these pioneers and these curious people and these crazy people who did what they did because of their passion. And they sacrificed so much for that. It's important for us to highlight this and to highlight the connections and the reasons why they do these things, sometimes in ways that can be very dry, and really tell the story in a way that's connecting and sexy to a person who may never have seen the ocean.
I never saw the ocean until I was, I did see the ocean my first time when I grew up in the Midwest. I didn't scuba dive until I was 20. Something, but I never saw the ocean until I was in like 6 or 7 years old. And then I did not see it again until I went to school for marine biology. Can you believe it? But it's because of I connected some way, somehow from the Midwest. And those are it had a lot to do with things that I saw on television. I had great support and family, but they had no clue about the ocean, but they supported whatever I was interested in doing, but we had those methods of sharing. Now we have even more methods of sharing the stories. And you're right. We have to continue to share those stories so that we're meeting connecting people and connecting the dots is what I like to say. Maybe I should change it to connecting the bubbles instead. I keep saying dots, but now I'm on this bubble thing with my background here, but I know we could keep talking. I feel like we only started talking, but we are like having to probably wrap up here, but how can, you know, people continue to, I just want to share, how can follow Proteus? Because as you said, deployment and things are starting to take place and things are really moving with Proteus. Where can they follow more information about what you're doing right now with Proteus and all the other projects that you're involved in? What's the best way for them to continue to stay connected to the bubbles?
And so with Proteus, it's very simple. You can go on all our socials. We post all the time. ProteusGroup.com is the website where we also have a lot of the updates, and you can dive deeper, no pun intended, into some of the details of what the Proteus ecosystem is, what our mission is, where we're going, who's involved, so on and so forth. And to your point earlier about you and your family, I bet that since you've fallen in love with the ocean, you have been, knowingly or not, influencing your circle of family and friends from your passion. And it's the best possible infection that people can have is being infected with your passion and your drive and your love for what you do.
Yeah.
And this is really important. We can do all the science in the world. We can do all the new tech and engineering in the world. But unless we hit people in the most profound way possible, which is our emotions, right?
Yeah.
We don't move the needle. And if we're going to move the needle in progress, whatever your definition of progress is, progress in business, progress in technologies, progress in science, progress in education, and so on and so forth, we need to be able to have that campfire story, which thankfully you're doing here on this podcast, in ways that get people interested and curious. And then they can be part of the adventure, whether it's in person or virtually. Hopefully we'll lock them in for the rest of their lives
exactly.
In a way that is, that makes them better human beings than we've been in our generation and that our forefathers were before us, so that we can drive towards a better future for the next generation so that they can benefit from those things that we've taken for granted.
Yeah, for sure. I think you said that so well in wrapping us up today. And I really do think, I said it at the beginning, that we need another podcast because I feel like we didn't cover enough stuff. And I'm going to propose that our next podcast is in person in Curaçao at the site of where Proteus is going to be, so we can bring people out there and get them to see what we both love about the marine space and help create more awareness about the opportunities for solutions and opportunities that data and research and everything are giving us to really engage with the marine space that is such, like you said at the beginning, a lifeblood for us and for our community. And that's really where we're at. So I really cannot say thank you enough for spending this last hour with me just chatting. And I hope that we're going to get many more chats to come, and you'll be coming to visit us again at the boat show this year, I hope. So we'll talk more. And with that, is there anything, last words that you want to say before we get off? Or I feel like you said some great nuggets of wisdom that I'm going to go back and like grab, but anything, last words before we sign off?
100%. Hopefully there won't be last words. Hopefully we'll get that chance to get that second,
last words for this episode. Let me clarify.
Catherine, first of all, thank you for potentially offering a second round, because I agree. We have so much more to talk about.
Oh, and gosh, yeah.
If it's in Curaçao, I would invite you to our new, which has been unannounced, temporary mission control site. So we do have a structure we can go check out. But more specifically, I would say that at the end of the day, it's thanks to things like this, people talking about things and sharing things, that we can make this world a better place. I can't thank you enough for your friendship and inviting me on here. And I look forward to our next adventure, of course. In the meantime, my last words on this podcast episode would be to treat the ocean as if your life depended on it, because it does. And maybe treat the ocean as if you would treat yourself, which hopefully is with kindness, with love, respect, and reverence to all the good things that you do and you're about. And if we do that, I think we'll be on a much better path, and we'll be able to tell a lot more good stories and positive stories in the future. And thank you for sharing the most precious resource, you, Catherine, and you, the public, which is time, something that we don't know how much we have on this planet. So let's make the best of it. Let's leverage all that time that we have on this planet to really create positive impact. And I thank you for sharing that time with me.
Oh, thank you. I think you wrapped that up very well on sharing your time. And so thanks again to everyone for joining us on the first episode of the Blue Economy Podcast. We look forward to the next one. And the next episode that we have with Fabian will be in the future. And hopefully I'm going to hold into it that we're going to go down to Curaçao sometime. If not, underwater. There's no limits in all of this. So thank you so much. And thank you to everyone for joining us on this episode. Have a great day and continue to connect the bubbles, I think is going to be my new tagline. Connect with the bubbles. So have a great day.